Amen. Amen. All right. So, glad to have you guys out. We are, as I said, in our fourth consideration. Last week, I introduced you guys to the whole concept of his needs, her needs. Can you pull up, I think it's PowerPoint number 49. And this is basically where we were last week, if you guys recall. Point number one are the first of the last four objectives that we want to try to address. The first one is acknowledging and addressing each other's needs. We spent a considerable time working through the idea that when you enter into covenant, you are actually admitting that you need the other person's help. So when it comes to marriage, if you don't understand the concept of vulnerability and dependence upon the other person as an essential component to the success of marriage, then you're going to have a really difficult time seeing the fruits of marriage work through. Because the institution of marriage really requires the humility of both the husband and the wife. It requires the humility of both individuals. Like tonight, we're going to be moving towards point number two. In fact, that's going to be where we land tonight. And we're going to be learning to avoid destructive behavior patterns that diminishes the quality of the relationship between spouses. Don't you think it's kind of a mystery in a certain sense that two people who say they love each other can do each other so much harm? Don't you think it's a kind of mystery? And when you, everywhere in the world, if you look at every venue in the world, and our world is filled with this theme that you and I are dealing with, relationship is at the core of what we're talking about. And when you look everywhere in the world, humanity is struggling with relationship. I mean, everywhere, every venue, whether it's on the job, whether it's at school, whether it's in the church, but certainly in the context of marriage, the dynamic or the seemingly difficulty of two people getting along at the highest levels seems to evade us. And we spend more time either ruining over our wounds that we inflict upon one another, or just being miffed as to why we can't reach the highest levels of happiness in the relationship. Do you find that to be the case with you? And I say that to set the context. If you don't believe that marriage is an enormous struggle, you don't need to be in the class. This is for us who are struggling through the greatest mystery in the world. If you do believe that, then the class will be beneficial, so long as you are in confessional mode. Remember, we talked about the attitude you have to make it through this class without the enemy getting advantage of you. The attitude you have to have in a class where we're cutting the lights on. And we haven't even really cut the lights all the way on. Believe me, we could go deeper. We could be more analytical. We could be much more introspective. But I don't know how profitable that will be. I do know this. Over the last 4 weeks, I have been highly blessed by those who have come to me and told me how relevant this class has been for them. I've had an opportunity now to engage in multiple councils with couples who know they need to do a better job in their relationship. They know it, and the class has just brought them to a place of brokenness to do it right. Because, you know, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. And you can lay out before an individual all the pearls of wisdom, but you can't make them apply them. And so what a tragedy to go away from a resource of truth and grace for such a germane institution as marriage and not be the better for it. And so I have been thankful. I do want to say this as we continue to work through our points tonight, is if this class has, you know, caused you to think through that you need to actually apply yourself more diligently in the area of marriage, and you don't know how to do that, call and get on the counseling list. so you can talk. One of the errors we all make, and I think us who have been married for a long time will admit this, is we wait way too long to get help in our marriages. Way too long. And by the time we get help, unfortunately, the help is not as effective as it could be to bring us up out of certain pits. And so the little advice they may give doesn't necessarily profit us because of how deep a pit we've dug in terms of our bad and destructive behavior patterns towards each other. And sometimes we find that our marriages collapse under the weight of just destructive behavior patterns. At other times, we have just made it to a place of saying we need help outside of ourselves to get this right. Tonight, you're going to hear a number of other very important concepts and points along the lines that we're dealing with now that I really want you to capture. And they're fundamentally under your rules of engagement 2 outline that you guys received last week, where it says meeting needs. Meeting needs. Most of the PowerPoints that are coming up here in a few moments will address that. And so, you know, you can have that ready. But I'm going to go through the PowerPoints, do a little exhortation with you here in a moment. And then we will we'll see 2 clips. I want us to see 2 clips tonight because we'll be off for 2 weeks. And then after the clips, in between clips, we'll have a break. After the clips, we'll do some Q&A and really seek to answer some questions. And I hope to see all of you back in 2 weeks on the 6th, I believe. And so the outline that you are going to want to have, if you don't, to follow. And you don't need it if you want to just follow. Some people can take excellent mental notes. Is meeting needs. Raise your hand if you agree with this. When you entered into marriage, no one told you that your job was to specifically and almost exclusively be committed to the meeting of the needs of your spouse. Raise your hand. There you go. Just need some truth. Need some truth. That's tragic. Isn't that tragic? Isn't it tragic that no one told you that when you signed up, your job was to seek to meet that person's need? And that person was to seek to meet your need. Now, when we talk about his needs, her needs, as a basic model and paradigm for the relationship, what we are talking about, which is why I love this marriage builder's model, is that his needs, her needs, his needs and her needs actually forces relationship. His needs, her need, forces relationship. It demands that you and I regard each other intentionally and intensively. The assumption that I married my wife in order to help meet her needs means that I should have given myself over to a lengthy personal self-assessment as to what my qualifications are to be and how I can grow in my character and in my calling to actually meet her needs and vice versa. When we don't have that sort of MO, what we fall prey to is around the 4th or 5th of the love busters, as you guys will note when we get into that area. It's fundamentally number 6, independent behavior. Independent behavior. We'll get back there in a moment. We're fairly quick into the relationship because we don't know how to get along. We don't know how to work through conflicts. And that's the bigger part of difficulty in marriage. You enter into conflicts, particularly early on, and you don't know how to resolve them. And they just become a whole series of unresolved conflicts. And that series of unresolved conflicts causes you to despair as to how to get along with your mate. And then rather than finding a solution to these unresolved conflicts, you end up setting up your own individual camp inside the camp. So it's a camp inside the camp, which is a house divided. And that's the first step to the enemy destroying the institution. The first step to the destruction of the institution is a camp inside the camp. That's why I do these seminars, because we got to destroy that, because that's basically saying I'm out, though I'm in. And that's the real problem with where we are today. And so this class, this series, Rules of Engagement, says there are rules to engagement. There are rules critical to you staying together and working it through. It's a non-negotiable necessity that we find a way to accomplish that. And when we are not accomplishing that, we need help in that regard. Okay, so let's go to work. We're going to be dealing with this learning to avoid destructive behavior patterns. Next PowerPoint 50. I want to repeat this with those of us who are married couples. And if you are thinking about getting married and your better half is with you, here are the ideas and the mentality that must go into the relationship. Do you agree that you married that person to assist in their meeting needs? Last week, I got a hearty yes. Do you agree? Do you agree that their needs actually become your needs because of covenant? Do you agree? Do you agree that you can do a better job at it than you have? That's critical right there. That one there is critical. Let me tell you why that one's critical. Because we are often willing to settle with shabby marriages. Like if you go through the Marriage Builders videos, one of the things that Dr. Harley will tell you is, he'll tell you that 20% of marriages overall are happy marriages. That the other 20% of marriages are subpar marriages that basically are barely existing. And that the other 60%, 20, 20, and 60, is government schools, I know, 20, 20, and 60, the other 60 are basically divorces, either actually that occur, or fundamentally they are divorces, although they stay within the context of marriage. The marriages are devastated. He's saying only 20% of people are committed to the endeavoring to make do a better job at the marriage. You know what that means? You and I are given to just settling down with a funky marriage. Now, the reason why we're doing this seminar is in order for us to be able to make a dent in that statistic, to affect that 20% and raise the number of quality marriages to 30% or 40%. And really, I'm doing it as a pastor because I want to see a better overall quality of marriages in the church. Because the quality of marriages in the church are no different than in the world. Now, if that's true, there's a major disconnect between our profession of faith in Christ and the resources of the gospel that's supposed to help us be all that Christ has called us to be, and the practical application of those biblical truths in the context of marriage. Somehow we cut off God in the marriage. Am I making some sense? Yeah, so actually the institution of marriage becomes what I would call ground zero for the warfare. We will look good everywhere else as a Christian. And once we go into the four walls of our own domain, we are actually practicing heathenism. A carnal Christianity that results in nothing but what the Bible says, the Gentiles blaspheme God. I mean, the Jews blaspheme God in the presence of the Gentiles by the way they conduct themselves. And so that's the reason why we're here. We're here for people who are not Christian. Because marriage is honorable in all and the bed is undefiled in the context of marriage. But I am primarily here so that my brothers and sisters at Grace can join me in producing a legacy over the next 20 years of stepping it up, of being able to have a better marriage with their spouses so that your children can believe in the institution of marriage. Let me share something with you, that right now the whole world, in terms of the secular world system, this postmodern culture in which we live, this relativistic culture that basically says, why do we need to be married? You know, most people are shacking around. You know, most people are living together. In a non-married context, you know that, right? That's just true. And the reason why they're doing it is because there's no fear of God. And marriage, in terms of the entering into covenant, is not appealing. It doesn't appeal. It doesn't have the draw that it used to. See, the institution of marriage used to draw people because the benefits were obvious. The security factor, the comfort, the resources that marriage depicts used to be there. Today it's not there. And so people say, why get married? Well, it's the job of the church to raise the level of the quality of marriage and to demonstrate that marriage is such a wonderful, magnificent, profoundly redemptive and salvific character building institution that everyone ought to want to get married. That's our job, is to raise that level. So our next generation, our Gen Xers, will not be saying, why do I need to get married? All we need to do is just live together, pay the bills and do our thing. If it don't work, we just pull out. Okay, so your job and mine is to debunk that myth. And that's the whole point. But the only way we're going to do that is we're going to have to discover something that I think you're going to learn tonight through the PowerPoint. And that's this. You really do need the Spirit of God. You will not do marriage successfully if you are operating out of the flesh. Carnality cannot accomplish the unity that God calls for two people. Carnality can't get it done. You guys follow what I'm saying? This is hard work, and it's going to require that. So we're going to be moving forward here in a moment. Do you agree that you can do a better job at that than you have? Yes. Are you ready to acknowledge his needs, her needs? What's the answer? Yes. Okay, so today before God, you are accountable for what you said. Today before God, you are accountable. Before I'll meet you at judgment. You can smile all you want to. On the day of judgment, I'm not going to be dressed like this. I'm going to have on my officer's outfit. And I'll be standing speaking for the God who crowned me and anointed me as a pastor and a teacher and as a father and as a husband and as a grandfather, who called me to this institution right along with you, because I'm under obligation to live this thing out. I got a wife over there. I got to live this thing out in front of her. She does me. And then we got to meet in the judgment. You guys understand that? So you can laugh. But what the statement said is we are called to meet each other's needs. So from here on out, for those of you who are married couples, that's your number one job. Let's see, our next PowerPoint. I think we're going to PowerPoint number 57. Let's go to PowerPoint number 57. 57. All right. Now, we're dealing with still the idea of his needs, her needs, and this is in your outline, meeting needs. I just want to talk about this briefly because I really don't think I need to spend a whole lot of time on it. Now, I said to myself, I'm going to try to catch this part on the back end. The his needs, her needs thing. It is important. It is important. Like, how many of you guys filled out the his needs, her needs sheet last week? Good. 90% of you. How many of you guys swapped with your partners? Okay, good. You can put your hand down now. I want to ask the question. How many of you guys actually practiced meeting each other's needs? Okay. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. So now, I wish I had my cameraman in here. Because, watch this. Thank you for lifting your hand. That's exactly what I wanted to happen. See, one of the things that goes on in Christianity is, are you ready for this? We just talk. We don't act on biblical principles. We just talk. Are you guys hearing what I'm saying? And it seems like every imperative that God gives us for our good, we go, amen. But we don't have the zeal and the passion to simply implement it. So I'm glad. One of the reasons I love this Marriage Builders program is because it demands that you go to work right away. One of the things you're going to learn if you haven't already picked up on this program is, if you and I, if me and my wife are inexorably bound to negotiate everything, that means I'm forced to interact with her on everything. And her, the moment that I say I don't want to be involved in that, I don't care about that, I'm not interested in that, or I'm not going to cooperate, the moment I do that, are you ready? I'm telling her she's not the most important person in my life. This is why I love this Marriage Builders program. I want you guys to get this. See, the system demands that I prove every day that she's the most important person in my life. Less Christ. And her too. So on those days I say, you know, honey, I need you to do this. And she is lackadaisical or does not do it or does not want to do it. She's telling me, you are not the most important person in my life. today. And now it becomes more vivid and more explicit and more obvious. It's like the law, right? You ought to stop at that corner because, you know, people are running through that four-way street. And if you don't stop, you can run into somebody. You put a stop sign up there, you're supposed to stop. You run that stop sign, you're guilty in your conscience because someone said stop. They put a stop sign up there. As the word says, when the commandment comes, then the transgression is made even more exceedingly sinful because there's a law there. So this kind of teaching forces us to see how sinful we are in our selfishness not to be committed to, engaged in the continual, relentless pursuit of loving our spouses. I'm bound by this system. So now let's talk about men's needs, women's needs briefly here. I don't actually agree with the order of this, but I know that it's fairly true. So generally it has been stated that men's needs fall out like this. And I'm sure, ladies, you will agree with this by and large, but if you've been around long enough and you have a deeper experience with God and your spouse as well, you would be able to readjust some of these priorities. They say for men, the number one need that men have is sexual fulfillment. How many of you ladies agree with that? There you go. You got about 30%. 40%. How many of you disagree with that? Ooh, you ain't hardly got none. The vast majority agree that sexual fulfillment is at the top of the list. The statistics would say yes. And probably honesty on the part of men would say yes. I think that that statement actually is indicative of another problem. I actually think it's indicative of another problem. We're going to be going deeply into Romans chapter 1 here over the next several weeks, and I'm going to demonstrate that pathologies and behaviors and actions on the part of human beings are really symptoms of a deeper problem. And when men are talking about, you know, I'm happy when I can have my sex, they are really actually substituting an inferior satisfaction for a greater need. Are you guys hearing what I'm saying? That sexual gratification is not at the top of the list of mature men's needs. This is true. Sexual gratification is not at the top of the list of mature men's needs. It's at the top of the list of childish men's needs. And I'm speaking from a deeply theological standpoint, maybe even psychologically. Because sexual fulfillment for men is something that's a bit different than that for women, as you know. It's a key of affirmation. Sexual fulfillment is a key of affirmation for men. When men are sexually fulfilled with the covenant partner, they are being affirmed in their manhood, being affirmed in their masculinity, being affirmed in their self-worth. So for them, it's a token of affirmation. You guys hear what I just said? It's a token of affirmation. Because men struggle with respect. They struggle with dignity. They struggle with securities of all sorts. And for them, when they don't find that respect or that security or that dignity in God, they seek it in the comfort of sexual pleasure. Am I making some sense? And fundamentally, what the woman is doing is affirming his masculinity, his need for respect, his need for significance, his need for relevance. We could go all the way back to childhood and the bonding factor too, but I'm just going to leave it right there. For most mature men, it's not about sex. Now, is it true that for women, their number one need is affection? I think so. But remember how we dealt with the class and I said, you can always challenge the propositions that are there. Because those propositions are what we call general assessments. They're not per capita true for every person. I actually think the priority of affection is something that all healthy human beings want. I think so. I think affection is something that all healthy human beings want and need. I think it ought to be at the top of the list for men as well, to be honest with you. But some of you said not affection. That's kind of weird to me. I'm not going to sidetrack right now, but that's kind of weird. As a female, if affection, unless you are defining affection differently than I am, that you would be willing to simply have an affectionless conversation, an affectionless honesty and openness, an affectionless financial commitment, family commitment. You see what I'm getting at? Well, after the film, we can talk about that. If you have an insight that we need to benefit from in terms of affection not being at the highest level for your security, for your sense of well-being, for your sense of comfort, I'd like to know. But for the men, it's sexual fulfillment, recreational companionship, and in our vernacular, we would say kind of a buddy. You know what I'm saying? Somebody that has the same sort of passions about extracurriculums that we do. Someone we can kick it with. I actually agree with that. I believe one of the reasons me and my wife have been together for so long is that we have had very similar recreational occupations. We both like sports. We like activities and events. Similarly, and because of that, it has allowed us to be, you know, attached at the hip for a long time. Years ago, when we were young people, if you would have met Barbara and Jesse in the street, we would have kind of been like, she may not agree, what's it, Bonnie and Clyde. Bonnie and Clyde. Sonny and Cher. That's crazy. Sonny and Cher. Okay. But in our youth, we would have been running the street wearing the same sweat clothes, same gear and stuff like that. You know, we'd have been looking like twins because we did a lot of stuff alike. That's a great sense of comfort for a man to have a spouse who kicks it with him. Knows sports, likes sports, knows this, likes that. Great comfort. And then on top of that, you get the love, too. You can't beat a life like that. You get a buddy and a lover. Man! And we still got some of that, too. We still have some of that. That part I love. He said that the stats go like this. They want an attractive spouse. I can see that with both parties. And when you see the videos on this, you can look at, they have four videos of his knees, her knees, and I would recommend you watch them. Again, it's marriagebuilders.com. Watch them over and over again and pull out the subtle truths that they share with you. Domestic support, and that word is in contingency, domestic support. A man wants a wife who is willing to actually govern the household. Deal with the things of the home. That is a biblical calling. That is a biblical calling. Contingent meaning, though, however, because some women are forced to, by virtue of the circumstance, to be the superior breadwinner, one who brings in more money. So she obviously is not going to necessarily be the one taking care of the home. And sometimes men do a great job of taking care of the home. And so those roles can be swapped in that regard. So, you know, that's contingent. It's not necessarily so that she has to be the one taking care of the home. But what a man definitely needs, these last two, I think, are actually, they need to actually be first, in my opinion. Admiration, respect, and honor. To me, what a man wants is a wife that admires him, respects him, and honors him. That's what he wants. If you can get a wife that truly, sincerely admires you, what that simply means is that there are characteristics and attributes in your life that are virtuous enough for her to respond to them. They resonate with her. They resonate. And those become qualities intrinsic to your character of which she responds to. One of my his needs, her needs, as I would share with my wife, is a continual audible affirmation of my labors for her. Women need that too. But men definitely need their wives to audibilize what they do. Tell them, you know, what they have done. Remind them how hard they work. Remember what we talked about? Marriage is the relationship of extraordinary care. And if we take the extra off, we only have ordinary. And if we end up with an ordinary marriage, pretty soon we start taking each other for what? Right. And once you're taking each other for granted, you are not giving the accolades. You are not telling them how important they are. And they're longing for that. after a hard day's work every day, when they come home to you, they're longing for an affirmation. How'd your day go? I'm so glad you're a hardworking man, da, 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 da. That goes a long way to sowing what we call love notes into the bank. Obviously, our women need those too. See how important that reciprocation is on the level of audibles? So we're going to learn something over the several years. So this list is there. Now, the next thing I want us to do is just jump right now into what I consider the very, very important area. And that is, while we have these list of needs, and while you and I are called upon to actually service our spouse in that area, which means that we are called to a kind of life of selflessness, voluntary commitment to be selfless towards them. The problem is we look up one day and we have violated that objective. This is where we are into the category of love busters. Pull up, I think it's PowerPoint number 50, number 60. Let me see where we are. Maybe it's 57. 60, let's see here. Here it is. All right, we'll start there. Back up to 59. I want to see something. I'm just nosy. Keep going back. 57. Okay, yeah, this is what I want to do. 57. Let's see if we're at 57. Okay, good. Go to 58. Okay, so this will help me. That's 55. 58. You got your glasses on, sweetheart? You got them on? Okay. There we go. Here we go. Now, think about this. This is the question. If, in fact, we are called upon to meet each other's needs, isn't this an apropos second follow-up question? How do I become an expert in meeting my spouse's needs? Fabulous question. Write it down. Write it down. That's where I'm at. In the last leg of my run, for the next 50 years of my marriage, I want to become an expert at meeting my spouse's needs. I want to get a PhD, a couple, two or three of them, in meeting her needs. I want to become so good at meeting my wife's needs that my great-great-grandchildren gonna jump over their daddy, granddaddy, great-granddaddy and come to me and ask great-great-great-granddaddy, how did you meet great-great-great-grandmama's needs? Because you did a great job. That's what I want to be able to do. I want to be able to have them come to me and say, how do you do it? So that's my job over the next several years, to get a PhD in becoming an expert in meeting her needs. Now, that's hard work, but I have already confessed I need the Spirit of God. I've already confessed that I've got to walk in the Spirit. I've already confessed that I need to be conformed to the image of Jesus Christ if I'm going to meet my needs, my wife's needs, as an expert. Because the only person that knows how to do that is Jesus. He's the best husband in the world. But he's on my side. He told me he'll help me. I can do all things through him who what? Strengthens me. So I'm going for it. I'm going for it. Are you hearing me? I'm going for it. So you guys pray for me. How do you become an expert in meeting your spouse's need? First is going to be work. Work. This is the problem. We get lazy in marriage. Remember the Proverbs? I went by the house of the sluggard. Last week, remember? And it was all grown over with thorns and nets, the field of the sluggard. The wall was broken down, thorns and nettles everywhere. What did it describe? A land, a piece of property, home that had been neglected. No one keeping it up. No tiller, no keeper of the home, no provider of the home, no one adorning that house. It's like a family who has abandoned all of the biblical principles that causes the institution of marriage and family to be something coveted for. So what is it going to take? It's going to take work. What else is it going to take? Frequency at it. In other words, I have to know that if I'm going to be an expert at meeting my wife's needs, I can't settle for hitting and missing. Like doing it 1 week and then for 3 months not doing it. And then jump start at it again. I can't do it in hits and fits. I got to be committed to a daily grind at developing a pattern of life that regards her needs at the highest level every day. So that, watch this, the frequency of it will become a habit. See the last line? When you become habitual at something, it's the consequence of intentionality and frequency. Like any athlete, like any professional, they become good because they do it a lot. Am I making some sense? They do it a lot. And here's the difference between frequency and habit. Are you ready? Habit is when it becomes effortless. So let me run through this briefly. Work, that means it has to be effective. How do I become an expert in meeting my spouse's needs? I have to be able to actually meet her needs and not meet what I think her needs are. Big old problem in marriages, right? Some husbands have wives who are allergic to flowers. Guess what they bring her every holiday? Flowers. Do you think that's sowing any love notes into the bank account? Units of notes, don't start. Do you think that's sowing anything in there? No. Why? Because you're not scratching her itch. You're not scratching her itch. Stay with me now. So can I keep talking? Watch this. You can't determine what her needs are. Brother, as soon as you start telling her what her needs are, you're not communicating. You're controlling. You're running the show. Honey, I know what you need. No, you don't. She knows what she needs. And you're going to have to ask her maybe 100 times until you get it. And you know, I love massaging one of my love languages is touch. That's why those of you at Grace who know me, most of you, we touch each other, don't we? That's a love language for me. So I love massaging my wife. I tell my brothers, why don't you massage your women, man? They need massages. They have to put up with you all day long. By the time they hit the bed, their neck is all just sore. What? You don't know how to just grab and massage for 5 minutes? That'll get you so many notes in the bank. Am I telling the truth? That'll get you so many notes in the bank. And don't go to rubbing the feet. It's on. I'm just telling you. Crawl on down to the bottom and start playing with those feet. You will have gumbo for weeks. I don't know a woman who won't just, hey, my man. Because we all stress. Don't we? We all stress. By the time we hit the bed, we are stressing. And so my love language is that. And sometimes my wife will say, no, 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 not there. Here. You know what I'm talking about? Man, you're wasting your energy. You're going to get tired in a second and you still won't have scratched me where I needed scratching. It's important to get it. Go down, go to the left, and stop right there. Now, stay right there. That's it. You know what that requires? Humility. And you have to be goal-oriented. Your job is to meet her need. Not tell her where the scratch is. I see a scratch. No, it's here. No, meet her need. Do it habitually, and it will be natural, normative, and effortless. I never get tired of giving my wife a massage because I've seen the benefits over the years. But also in the process of meeting each other's needs, here's the other word that I really want to enter into your thoughts. Because this is where the breakdown occurs, right here, mutual. See the term mutual? This is where the breakdown occurs. You're going to see that tonight as we get into the whole issue of bad behavior patterns, mutuality. How do we mutually satisfy each other? Mutuality. How do we come to mutual agreement? How do we mutually determine which way to go? How do we resolve matters that are equally important to both of us, but only one answer can be accomplished at a time, and do it where the one is not defrauded and the other has the advantage? That is the area and crux of most couples' problems. And we'll deal with that as we work through our 6 Love Buster points tonight briefly. But what we want to do is become experts in our spouse's needs mutually. It has to be a mutual bilateral agreement. You know what bilateral is? It's the opposite of unilateral. You know what that means? When I go to massage my wife's back, which is the analogy I'm using, I already know that we have an agreement that she's going to correspond. Did that go? You know what that means? That means she automatically knows that she is obligated to return in kind, because that's what love does. Love returns in kind. Love returns in kind. Love returns in kind. No, not the same, but in kind. Like, I don't necessarily need a massage. You understand what I'm saying? But because she knows who I am, she will reciprocate somewhere down the line. That way, we are now being mutual, and we are not having a lopsided relationship, where, as I taught you last week, as we talked about the joint of a mutual agreement, that policy, the idea of joint of mutual agreement, and we'll deal with that when we come back from the vacation, the policy of joint agreement is designed to make sure that you guys have an equilibrium in your relationship where both parties benefit. Very frequently in relationships, there is a taker mentality who ends up absorbing all of the benefits, leaving the other person high and dry of resources because of no reciprocation. Am I making some sense? And that's going to open the door for the four horsemen of the apocalypse. Who wasn't here when we looked at the four horsemen of the apocalypse? Good, most of you guys were. The four horsemen of the apocalypse becomes the consequence of not making sure that we practice a bilateral agreement relationship. A bilateral agreement relationship. So go up to PowerPoint 33 through 40. I want to remind us of what it looks like when we as a couple do not work together to maintain an equilibrium in the marriage where both persons are being satisfied continually. So the four horsemen of the apocalypse are attitudes and behaviors that spouses take on when they are frustrated with each other because the needs are not being met. Put your seatbelts on. Getting ready to get rough, because we're getting ready to face some truth. This is where most marriages live, right here. Terrible, but it's true. The four horsemen of the apocalypse. What are they? Contempt, criticism, stonewalling, and defensiveness. These four attitudes and behaviors will ride through your marriage and devastate everything until the relationship is what? Is that true? It's absolutely true. Think about it. We must learn the keys to avoiding these damnable and spiritually destructive practices, from controlling our mind. It starts in the mind. Our mouth comes out of the mouth. And our what? That's right. And I've been counseling for a long time. Actions. What I have learned over the years, and this is an uncanny truth. Are you ready? Men and women are equal in how horrible they treat each other. Men and women are equal. In other words, it's not lopsided. I don't find like more women being treated wrong than men. Now, women will feel like that's the case. And I don't find more men being treated wrong than women. Watch this. But men will feel like that's the case. Men will come in and say, Pastor, how come the brothers always being dogged? And I'll go, they're not. Men and women are equally depraved, equally sinful, equally mean, equally nasty. Equally. So in your relationship, it might be one spouse over against the other. But as a rule, men can be contemptuous, can't they? They can be critical. They can stonewall and be defensive. PowerPoint 34. Let's work through these right quick. I just want you to see this. My spouse and I continually argue and nothing gets resolved. Eventually, he shuts down when I get so angry and he won't talk anymore. What can I? Well, what did that mean? What was that? Was that one of those auto body reactions? You know, kind of a Freudian slip? I get so angry when he won't talk anymore. What can I do to change this pattern? Because nothing is being what? Have you ever been there? How many? There you go. See, now this is why I'm saying we are at the heart of the problem here. How to resolve conflict. Here's the humbling thing about marriages. Are you ready? We don't know how to resolve conflict. We just don't. 35. My spouse and I continually argue and nothing gets resolved. Eventually, he shuts down when I get so angry he won't talk. Now, what can I do to change this pattern because nothing is resolved? What's occurring here is that you individually, or both of you, are doing something referred to as the four horsemen of the apocalypse. Keep going. Contempt. What is contempt? Contempt is when you are using contempt against your spouse when you disdain, scorn, imply strong feelings of disapproval and aversion toward what seems base, mean, or worthless in them. When you are contemptuous of your spouse, are you ready? You are always looking for the worst part of them. And you actually use that to sustain your offense. You always target only their negative characteristics. And you hone in on that in order to build a pedestal for yourself over against them. Are you hearing me? That's called contempt. Like contempt of court is when you disregard the majesty of the court, the authority of the court, the structure of the court, the government of the court, the power of the court. In a marriage, in the eyes of God, it's 100 times worse to contempt your spouse than it is to contempt the civil courts of the land. In God's eyes, contempting your spouse is heinously worse than your contempt of the judge in the civil courts. God would rather you contempt the judge in the civil courts than you contempt your spouse. That's exactly right. What does it look like? This sister looks, is she a good example of a contemptuous? We labored to find a non-black sister that could actually depict contemptuousness. Couldn't find none. So we succumb to the angry black woman. But all my non-black sisters can totally agree. Can't you guys totally agree? Look at it. Contempt is disapproval tinged with disgust. Disapproval tinged with disgust. I write the question roots. What is the root of this contempt? I want you guys to think about it. If you're struggling through it, I want you to think about it. The class will unveil it over the next several weeks. What is the root of you sustaining a contemptuous attitude towards your wife or your husband? Can I tell you a couple in my mind? I'll just help you with it. A sense of insecurity. A sense of low self-esteem. When you sustain that kind of contempt against them, you don't have a real high value of yourself. It can be rooted in pride or fear. The pride and fear that if you make them something, you will become nothing. Does that make some sense? And so there are people whom you know, they're contemptuous of everyone. They look for the bad in everyone. They never see the good in anyone. Because they are longing and craving for someone to say, you're great. Now, this goes back to marrying your spouse and not really knowing their character and not knowing their deficits and not knowing what your calling is to help grow them up out of that sort of stuff. Because you'll marry a person with those deficits, those insecurities, with those lackings. Am I making some sense? But when it comes up in the context of marriage, it's because over the long term, your spouse has not met your needs because you guys haven't had a healthy enough communication, effective enough communication base, and you become angry, and now you are being contemptuous of them. You're getting ready to move to the next one, PowerPoint 37, which is criticism. Criticism is the act of passing judgment as to the merits of anything. The act of passing severe judgment and censure or fault finding. Anybody know anything about that? Really, I consider that the overflow of contempt. that contempt is what you do internally. You mentally construct a defense and you tear down any possibility that the subject in front of you or the person in front of you or the people or the situation merits your adoration or your affirmation of good. But eventually what comes out of you is criticism. Let me see if I can put it this way, because these are definitely in the rules of, these are in the bad behavior videos that we're going to watch. But I'm going to share this with you. If you are critical of your spouse in an audible way on a consistent level, you actually need help. If you are criticizing your spouse on a frequent level, you need help. You have issues. Very, very big issues. There's a difference in being objectively and analytically critical over practices and behaviors that are not right, and being severe in your judgment with the objective of being injurious to your spouse. Do you guys understand the difference? There's a difference between being objectively critical and analytical about a behavior pattern. We're only humans. So we do things that are wrong to each other. And you can say, I don't like that, that is not right. Or you can say, I don't like that, and I don't like, it's not right, of what your spouse may be doing to others, to the children, or to family members, or on their job. Your spouse is flawed, and they need to be told by you when they are behaving in a manner less than biblical. Does that make some sense? Right. And so they can be wrong in how they're handling a thing, and you can be objectively critical because you care about their character. Hey, you need to stop that. Criticism then moves to what we call, point number 38, stonewalling. Here's stonewalling. Stonewalling is a refusal to communicate or cooperate. You guys see that? Now, generally stonewalling comes up when, after so long that you and your spouse have not been able to actually work through their issues, you get frustrated. Stonewalling is a tactic of saying, I'm actually stopping the process of communication dead in its track because I have the power to do it. See, it takes two to talk. And everybody has the power to stonewall. You know that, right? You know what kills us? Is when our kids stonewall us. It shows you how powerless you are even with your children. I'm not just talking about teenagers. Like a little boy or a little girl can stonewall you. 4 or 5 years, they can actually shut you down. And you come to discover, man, I don't have any authority at all if they don't let me. Now you can start becoming a brute beast and an ogre and start using fear tactics, but you're going to lose that relationship. Remember, rules without relationship equals what? Rebellion. Rules without relationship equals rebellion. So when my daughter is stonewalling or my son is stonewalling me, I know that the communication has broken down and I've got to find a civil way to reach them so we can break that wall down again, right? But it's bad when couples do it. This is the precursor to divorce when stonewalling occurs. Such behavior occurs in situations such as marriages, guidance counseling, diplomatic negotiations, politics, and legal cases. Body language may indicate and reinforce this by avoiding contact and engagement with the other party. Woo! Woo! Are we hitting home right now? Stonewalling can be your avoidance of your spouse. Like coming in and going in the other direction. Avoiding having to come into contact with them because you will have to address issues. Or you don't even want to say hi to them. The use of deflection in a conversation in order to render a conversation to be pointless. Anybody know what I'm talking about there? You're talking. And because they want a stonewall, bloop, they go into another. They run you down a rabbit trail. Now, what does the price of tea in China have to do with us paying the bill that needs to be paid tomorrow? See what I'm getting at? That's called stonewalling. Now, they do that when they want to demonstrate with you that they're mad at you and they don't want to cooperate, even in normal stuff. Very difficult. Very difficult. Tactics in stonewalling include giving sparse and vague responses. Doesn't that eat you up? Sparse and vague responses. Refusing to answer questions. Or responding to questions with an additional question. Do not get Socratic on me. Sherlock Holmes. But when they are stonewalling, that's what they will do. Right? Stonewalling means that you are not going to advance the conversation with the person because you are offended with them. That's making sense, right? And we've all experienced that if we've not been engaged in it. In most cases, stonewalling is used to create a delay compared to putting the conversation off forever. And we can ask what the roots of it are. Let's go to our fourth one. Defensiveness. This is the final one before we see our first clip. And we'll take a break after that, watch our second clip, and then we'll do a Q&A and close for tonight. Defensiveness. This is large. This is huge. Defensiveness is one of the mechanisms that people use when they are feeling unsafe in a conversation and can cause a conversation to go astray. From time to time, even the best of us can become defensive in a conversation. Now watch this. I want you to get this. This is interesting. The term defensiveness doesn't carry with it any sort of moral right. Like you and I can be defensive and be wrong. Like we can be holding up a defensive shield against our spouse because we don't want our spouse to actually be able to pinpoint a flaw in us. Are you guys hearing what I'm saying? On the other hand, we can be defensive when we don't want to be punished or hurt by our spouse because they are abusive. Are you hearing what I'm saying? So we will defend ourselves against abuse, and we will defend ourselves against actually being exposed. That decries an underlying problem. When either one of us are defensive, it really does mean that we don't trust each other to engage in open, honest dialogue to work through a problem because we feel like that person is our enemy. Does that make some sense? They are our enemy. And the relationship has devolved now into a very bad state. Pull up some of the evidences of it. Point number four. Now watch this. I want you to see what the signs of defensiveness are. You and I can put up the facade of a righteous indignation. Your spouse will say, well, you didn't do this. And you go, and you start giving all kinds of examples as to, you know, why you even raised it. I do this, I do that. Righteous indignation. Defensiveness is evidenced by kind of going overboard in your response of a thing. All I asked you to do was wash the dishes. You talked about what we did on our honeymoon and 50 years ago and 25 years. What does that got to do with washing the dishes? Defensiveness. Overstating your position. I want to show you how defensiveness works. Overstating your position. It's like you will defend your position and build a sort of, you know, Eiffel Tower of arguments. Your husband or your wife would look and say, you don't take all that. All it took was one or two, you know, responses. And I agree with you. No, they're going to build. They're going to get 100 feet up looking down at you. This is what I did. You're defensive. Overstating your position. Here's the third one. When you stop listening to them and listening more to your own inner conversation. Watch out for that. Watch out for it. He talking to you. She talking to you. And then the voice inside rises up and gets louder than they're talking to you. And your eyes glaze over because you know, you're not listening. Because in your mind, your voice that's on your shoulder giving you all kind of arguments to get him. You know I'm saying, you know I'm telling the truth, right? You know I'm telling the truth. Okay, I just said. All right. Listening more to your own inner conversation than you are to them. That's a wall. When you allow your voice to rise up, that's a wall. Okay? That's a wall. Agitation and perspiration. Now, you are defensive when, as soon as your spouse goes to talking to you, you go to sweating. And you easily irritate. So what's that about? All we're doing is trying to solve a problem here. And you're just agitated, defensive. Ladies and gentlemen, none of these characteristics depict what it means to walk in the Spirit. So we're going to see that as we work through this. Here's another one. When you're defensive, you go to talking rapidly and in higher pitched voices. I told you I didn't want you to do that. I told you I didn't. Didn't I tell you? Didn't I tell you? Just leave. You just go way up. Woo, woo, woo. Where'd that come from? And they're just venting because they are so full of anger. They attack the other person. They become judgmental, sullen. That's an interesting attitude. Sullen, who knows what that is? Who knows what sullen? I know we went to government school. Sullen, it's fundamentally, it's a withdrawal and sort of a diminishing of your spirit. So some people, when they are in a defensive mode, just become internally uncooperative. And even they become personally disoriented as a mechanism of not responding. Are you following me? They know how to just, I can't respond. They go, woe is me, I can't respond. Suspicion is a huge one. Suspicion, see? And then vindictiveness. The others is indecisive. You know your spouse is defensive when you give them a simple yes or no answer or a simple assignment and they are indecisive. And you scratch your head wondering, why is that? Well, defensiveness means that they are so put off by you that they don't want to cooperate. So indecisiveness becomes one of the evidences. Defensiveness also means they can be dominating. Defensiveness means they can be indirect. Passive aggression. You heard of it, right? Passive aggression. Blaming. That's huge in defensiveness. When people are defensive, as soon as you share with them something that they think might be an indictment against them, they immediately throw it back and blame you. Bossy. And the list goes on. That's all I wanted to do. Let me see here. Let's see if anything on 41. All right. So, no, I don't want to deal with that. I think I want to deal with just one more set maybe. No, I think I'm good right there. So here's what we're going to do now. Interesting insights, right? And I hope that what you did was to basically take mental notes to ask yourself, what category might I be in personally? Then how are these things affecting my own walk with both God and my spouse? Because these are terrible maladies. These are terrible places to be. They are destructive to marriages. Very destructive to marriages. So what I'm going to do now is have us to watch one clip of destructive behavior patterns. These are called love busters. After that, we'll take a break. We'll watch our second one, and we'll do a Q&A for tonight. So if you can pull that up. Yeah, hit that switch click. So they'll start making their way back in. I do want to talk about this first clip. So does Dr. Harley have a legitimate point when he makes the argument that, and Louis, hey Louis, shut that door as they come in. Does he have a legitimate argument when he says that, selfish demands will really put a strain on relationship? Does he have a legitimate? So there's an interesting dynamic there, because what he had to do was work through almost apologizing for what his basic argument is that what is your motive for how you communicate to your spouse? That's his basic argument. His argument is not so much whether or not you use imperatives or use requests as if commands are always bad. Personally, if you bought what he said verbatim and didn't do a little pushback, I always do. I challenge views, especially if I think that they're not completely comprehensive. For instance, I wholeheartedly believe that we ought not to be operating out of selfish demands where they become injurious to our spouse's spirit or well-being. But sometimes a demand is like unavoidable and absolutely critical in contexts where they need their spouse to cooperate. So, you know, I was just looking at the larger scope of it, and I said, in a world where there is no snowstorms, no mishaps, no car accidents, no emergencies of any kind, then you and I never have to use imperatives or commands. So I do want to set the context before we go to our second category of love busters. If you are going to sincerely engage your spouse in attitude adjustments with regards to how to talk to one another, be very pragmatic about it. This is what I wrote in my outline for you last week. Be careful not to go to any kind of extreme, because there are people who will say, don't ever use a demand or don't ever use an imperative. And I will say to you that that does not work in the real world. But if you use an imperative, your imperative ought to be based upon the situation, not a sort of habit or pattern of expression that indicates a lack of respect for your spouse. You guys know the difference? Like 2 weeks ago, my wife and my daughter inadvertently locked themselves out of the house. So I get a text on my cell phone. I mean, it happens. It happens, right? We don't have one of those special houses like y'all do, where you can wave your hand over the door and the door just opens up. Or you stick your finger up there, you know, like James Bond. No, we don't. If our key locked in the house, you know, we go out and lock the door, we get locked out. So what's that Friday night Bible study? And I just happened to pick my phone up right after the study. It's about 9:45. And I look and I get a text from my wife. And she generally doesn't text me in the evening unless it's an emergency. So I look at the text and the text says, you need to come home now. Trent and I are locked out. You know what we call that? A demand. And it has an element of selfishness to it. But it was contextual. You understand what I mean? It was contextual. She didn't have to say, do you feel like coming home right now? We'd like to actually get in the house, but if it bothers you, we'll sit out here and freeze to death until it occurs. Do you understand what I'm getting at? With that also, because I don't want my Christian brothers and sisters to be over-psychologized. Because whenever you build constructs or arguments are suppositions that have to do with, you know, trying to address an issue, if it doesn't have a broad enough application to real life scenarios, then it's too narrow. There will be times when your children will appropriately give you as parents a command. And it's completely appropriate. Right? So if daddy is being daddy and belligerent or something, and your daughter says, daddy, stop! That's an imperative. He ought to stop. You guys see what I'm saying? Imperatives are forms of communication that are so effective in getting things back on track, saving situations, stopping problems. They are essential in relationship. The issue is that you use them only where they are needed for the situation and not to become a tool or cudgel for controlling people. You guys see the difference in it. Very important. That's what I meant by, as you guys listen to these clips, make sure you keep your thinking caps on, remembering that what I told you, and be able to actually say, I challenge that argument on these bases. So obviously, he does a good job. I wouldn't have recommended the program if I didn't think so, but there are areas in which I'll challenge him. It's going to get a little bit more challenging for us in this next clip because he's going to deal with the last three. But I did want to say that If you are operating out of selfish demands and you are not being thoughtful of your spouse and you're violating all of the other prerequisites we've talked about, they are the most important person in our lives. We want to become expert at meeting their needs. Then you are creating an atmosphere of slavery. You are doing that. And a wife and children need to get away from you. Our husband and children need to get away from you as soon as possible. Here's my argument, that marriage is not a prison. And I've taught that for years. So just because it is a covenant, it doesn't mean one person gets to control everything going on in the marriage. There's stipulations on both sides, right? And that's what the whole idea of doing marriage in a biblical way. If the husband's a king, the wife's a queen. She has authority like he does. And so sometimes the problem is that going into marriage, we don't always know our authority. And if you don't learn your authority, then your spouse can take advantage of you. Is that true? Right. And so we have to. The second one is disrespectful judgments. Disrespectful judgments, again, fall in the category of what? Criticism. Criticisms. And criticisms aren't very attractive. His argument is, if we're using selfish demands because we are selfish, we will never build that continual emotional and romantic love in our spouse's life that we want. And then we wonder when the relationship is strained why that's the case. Because of the manner in which we have engaged them. You guys do agree with that, right? And so the idea of being disrespectful in your judgments really means you're out of control internally. When we become disrespectful in our judgments, what we are doing is basically saying, I want my way, and because I'm not being able to successfully negotiate with you, I'm going to just make a decree, like take my anvil and slam it down and say, you're guilty, right? In the courtroom of my own conscience against my spouse. Is that a good analogy? Because it does work. The problem is it violated all of the requisites we've talked about, right? You are the most important person in my life. I am going to become an expert at meeting your needs, and therefore I am going to avoid behavior patterns that actually withdraw or deplete the bank account and create that kind of inner disposition and pushback on your part towards me. The third one is angry outbursts. So what Dr. Harley was saying is that this is a progression. Selfish demands, disrespectful judgments lead to angry outbursts. Is that logical? Sure it is. Sure it is. When you and I get into angry outbursts, we're just like little kids wanting to have our way. Now we're having tantrums because we're not getting our way. Angry outbursts simply means that you don't have the answer. I said this before too, and this is just something for you to take, because I'm learning. I've been learning over the years that you really just have to learn how to think through issues. You have to think through issues. You have to work on better ways of resolving issues, how to respond to issues. Proverbs says, the righteous studieth to answer. So a situation comes up, I want to try to find a better way to resolve that. Angry outbursts to me are, the only reason an angry outburst would be like justified is when there is a complete rejection of all sound judgment on the part of a spouse or maybe a whole family, but that would be indicative of a breakdown of communication too, wouldn't it? If you find yourself compelled to have to just rage to get your spouse's attention or everybody's attention in the house, that's a breakdown in communication. That means we got to go back to the drawing board and learn how to talk civilly and work through our issues. And so what he is talking about is critical. Who wants to live with a what? Time bomb. And I have biblical text here. I don't want to deal with them tonight. You can read them on your own. Slavery is not what we had in mind. Critics aren't very attractive. And who wants to, the word should be live, with a time bomb. And now we're getting ready to deal with the last three. Annoying behavior, dishonesty, and independent behavior. Annoying behavior, don't be such a jerk. Dishonesty, there's no such thing as a white lie. That's a problem in marriages. When you aren't able to be honest, you destroy every form of security in relationship that you should have when you're dishonest. Every one of us knows intuitively when a person is being dishonest because they are not sharing enough of the truth to satisfy our sense of intuition. And over time, there's a pattern where they are short with their words, are careful on how they say a thing. You know how your spouse is. Honey, where you been? And then they say it a different way. Well, then, you know, we're obfuscating being honest. And that becomes problematic, doesn't it? And so the idea of there's no such thing as a white lie, what that drives couples to do, this is what I love about it, it drives you as a couple to walk in the light. Like the sad reality is that what we'll do if we're not honest people and people of integrity is we will walk in darkness with our spouse. We will set up a mode of operation where we are less than honest and we have pockets of separation and gaps in our relationship, places where we don't want them to go. I'm making some sense. And at that point, you're just setting up now. You're getting ready to set up now a divided household. You guys do understand that. Because what happens is where there should be reciprocation between the two persons at every level, like my wife ostensibly should have the freedom of knowing absolutely everything I'm doing 24 hours. Man, that's tough, isn't it? It's the truth, though. It's the truth. I should walk in such a way before God, Coram Deo, that my wife can ask me any questions she wants to about what I'm up to. And I should be honest and open with her. And if I'm not, then I'm having a problem with God. Am I making some sense? That's why the next three are going to be critically important, because by the time you get down to love buster number 6, independent behavior, your marriage is destroyed. You just haven't walked out the house yet. Okay? Your marriage is destroyed. Divided, we fall. We'll let that clip run, and then we'll spend a few minutes doing some Q&A, and then we'll go. My secretary told me that I think I may have miscommunicated. We're only off next week. The subsequent week, we're back on. Did you guys understand that? Or did you guys think we were off for 2 weeks? Only off for 1 week, okay? So we're back on the 6th. I think it's the 6th. All right, so we're going to watch one more clip. After that, have your questions so that we can do our healing, and then we'll go home. All right, so we'll pull up the next one. You up? There we go. Annoying behavior. And then dishonesty, right? Annoying behavior. All right, so let's just spend a few minutes. We're good here. I'll cut the mics on and just get some feedback. So I'll need a couple of runners here just to have some feedback. What do you think about what they said? And then I'll be more than willing to hear any needs you guys have so we can address that before we go home tonight. Need to get one over here and make sure that mic is on for me. What do you guys think? Anybody's observation about the Love Buster section? Go right there for a second, right there. Is it on? Make sure you tap it. It's on. Okay, there we go. Okay, so that mic is not up. Is it on? Make sure you don't. No, the light is on. Okay, so it's too low. Talk through it.
So Pastor, I absolutely just have to thank you for this class tonight.
There you go.
This class was absolutely awesome. I'm so glad that both my husband and I made a point of getting here tonight. Mm-hmm. I found so many times during the course of what you were teaching and what Dr. Harley was teaching, I found myself exhaling because I saw myself, and I want to say this as much to my husband as well, is I saw myself as well as just seeing him, because mm-hmm. it's so easy to see him. And I mean, I can point out everything about him that I want corrected, but I was able to see myself tonight. So that is really what I got out of this class, and I'm just grateful for this class.
Amen. Amen. It's I'm glad that you, there you go. Go ahead on. If couples are stuck in the me-only mode, we can never resolve our problems. It's virtually impossible in my own counseling that it's always one person's fault. So, and we just got work to do. The other two classes are going to be great too. So let's just keep pressing through. Other questions, observations, or needs? Here's one right here, Mr. Richard. If you have a question on that side, you can raise your hand so we can be ready to answer it on this side. Anybody on this side? Go ahead, Richard.
I wanted to kind of go back to the his needs, her needs. I did see the videos, and I don't know if it's still coming up or if it's something we might get back to, but there was one where it talked about making the list actionable, and I didn't know if we were going to see one on that.
But what is your question on that? Because what I want you guys to do is watch the videos as couples. That way you can practicate it for yourselves. You watch them over and over enough, then you begin to kind of understand what they're saying. We can talk about it. His needs and her needs we'll deal with on the back end. I wanted to deal with these behavior problems. But is there a question there around making it practicable for you?
I just wanted to come up.
Okay. All right. Anybody else? Any other questions? Any other observations? Any other needs? Don't be afraid to talk now. This is time to do it. It's worth it. If you got something deep down inside, bring it out. We're all family here. This is confession mode. This is not criticism mode. We are here to get better. Tony.
Now, you touched on love languages earlier, on the love language of touch. Will we be going over some of the other love languages?
I didn't plan on that because when you guys, we started the exercise on his needs, her needs. The his needs, her needs actually encompass the idea of love language. If you had filled out that his needs, her needs sincerely, what that means is you know yourself. And really, in order for this to work, you have to know yourself. Because how can you tell him or her what your needs are if you don't know yourself? And what's going to come out of your mouth to them is going to be your love language. But obviously, Dr. Chapman, whose book, The Five Love Languages, came out many years after Dr. Harley. Harley is an old veteran. Dr. Chapman is much newer. The Five Love Languages is a really good book. To me, it's basic stuff. Doesn't go into real depth, but it's a good basic book. And it's a good book if you don't know yourself. If you know yourself, you don't need that book. And what this model demands is that you know yourself so you can communicate yourself authentically to your spouse. But if your spouse doesn't know themselves, like a lot of couples don't, they need help on being able to discover who they are and what their needs are. And the five love languages will also help in that. But when we get back to class, we'll work on it more. And also, you're members of Grace. You can always sign up for counsel, because this is what we do a lot, okay? Because we want our marriages to be powerful and healthy and strong and vibrant. Is there a question over on this side? Any questions over this side? Okay, you can be ready. Melody?
So when you're in a relationship where it seems to be one-sided,
right,
or if you're with someone who's says that they love the Lord but portray something differently.
Can't hear you.
Portray something differently. How do you, wanting to maintain that relationship, do you continue? Like, there were some things that I saw in here tonight that I can actually work on.
That's what it's for.
And commit to those things. Will that in itself at least help?
No. It won't do anything for him. So the model here, and I said this at the opening of the series. This is important to know. If you're going to make marriage work, both parties have to be committed to it. Like, if one person is violating all of the biblical rules of love and respect and commitment and participation in all of the emotional and practical aspects of the marriage, that person has actually breached the marriage. I want you to think that through. So they are, what they are doing is, what they are doing is assuring that we're going to have a poor marriage. And what it demonstrates is that they do not love you. Are you guys hearing what I'm saying? I want to drive this home. You cannot say you love someone and hurt them. I don't care who you are. And this is where Christians have to make sure that you don't allow biblical terms like love to be reshaped into selfishness that amounts to taking and not giving. Because you can only make marriage a marriage where two parties agree that each person is the most important person in their life. Where you fail to do that, you are saying, I want to divorce you. And you're going to feel that way at the end. Because only one person can only give so much. And we've had many, many marriages where, you know, the woman and the man have lived and died in a miserable condition. They hated their marriage. Hey, cut that out back there. They hated their marriage because the other person didn't reciprocate. It was a pitiful marriage. Can I be honest with you guys? Those are pitiful marriages. And they're unbiblical. And that's the part that God hates. What he hates is that we violated covenant terms. I promise to love you. And then you get into marriage and just act like you're not married or make that person your enemy. They fundamentally have divorced you. The only thing that they haven't done is left. And some people are tormented because the person didn't leave. Right? Because they hurt you so much. So you can only take so much. And and at some point it breaks. You need to know that. And in some cases, I'm just going to add one more caveat. The only time an individual will wake up to their wretched selfishness is when that spouse leaves. That's the only time they wake up. That's the only time they wake up. I'll leave it like that. Because it takes two to love. Over here, Michael.
Pastor, I seem to hear Dr. Hartley and his wife talk about kind of like our own sinful, selfish natures that are natural in and of them, of ourselves. And they seem to be saying that we had to engage one another almost counterintuitive fashion. To be able to do that on a consistent basis, is that where we need to be walking in the Spirit at all times to be able to maintain that kind of counterintuitive mindset?
If I didn't think you guys were too tired, I would take you through 10 PowerPoints that I have that's connected to the class. And that PowerPoint is Galatians chapter 5. So now think about it for a moment. So the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, goodness, temperance, faith, meekness, self-control. All of the virtues that make for a good person in their relationship with the other person, right? Those are critical components to a healthy, vibrant relationship. That's the fruit of the Spirit. That's what I meant earlier when I said, without the Spirit of God, you can't do biblical marriage. You cannot do biblical marriage without the Spirit of God. Because biblical marriage requires the Spirit of God for us to be counterintuitive and pro-loving. You need the third person. That's why in our Rules of Engagement first class, remember the three-pronged principle that I set up? The only way that you can do biblical marriage is with a Bible-based, Spirit-aided, so it's a B, Bible-based, Spirit-aided, cross-centered theology. Without the cross, you do not have a forgiving mechanism. A forgiveness mechanism is critical. Without the Spirit of God, you don't have the power to walk in the fruit of the Spirit. Without the Bible, you don't have the knowledge to be able to do it. It has to be a Bible-based, Spirit-aided, cross-centered theology. It has to be. We're not talking humanism here. We're talking Christianity. And this is where Christian marriages are under the radar, carnal, because they are not operating out of a biblical-based, spirit-aided, cross-centered theology. You need the cross because you're guilty every day. You need the blood because we fall every day. We need the Spirit of God because we can't do what's right without Him. We need the Word of God because without knowledge, my people perish. So that's a premise for loving one another. That theology is critical. And you know, so we'll be dealing with that when we come back. We'll come back and deal with that as the element. So my argument is the reason why marriages crash is because of carnality. Carnality is always self-centered. And when you look at the works of the flesh, they are carnal tendencies that rise to the level of adultery and idolatry and murder. But they start with envy and strife and jealousy and contentions and suspicions. Those basic inner maladies that you and I have talked about. And so you and I have to ask the question, do we walk in the flesh in our marriages or do we walk in the spirit? Am I making some sense? All right, so I hope that helps. Any on this side, my sister, yes.
You just answered my question, but my question was that, you know, when I got married, wasn't really in this church. So Christ wasn't at the head of my life. I mean, I grew up in church, but, you know, I had strayed away. So you sort of think that you're doing things right. And then I found that a lot of instances that the things that I see that happen in my family, I was repeating.
Right.
But you don't know what you don't know because, you know, we never was really trained in how to have a relationship.
Right.
And now that you're in the church and all the damage been done.
Right.
So, you know, I'm just learning that, you know, you can go back and do it right.
Yes, ma'am. I don't care how old you are. You want to get it right, period. And that's why I'm doing it now with our church, because our churches are not doing it. So I'm going to end up going around helping churches with this program, because the big white elephant in churches are their marriages are horrible. I've been telling pastors that for over the last 6 months. I've been letting other pastors know, hey, I got this program. Me and my boys and my ladies would be glad to come to your church and help you. They shrink back in fear. You know why? Because they don't want to open up a can of worms. Because they don't know where to start with helping people cut the lights on and deal with the reality of a broken relationship. They don't even know where to start. So I have yet to get any of the calls from my local pastor brethren. And we all are a product of our culture. I told us that. We are simply a product of our culture. You have to be ready to build. Marriage is a building process. You'll see that in 2 weeks. It's a building process. It's a building process. Pull up for me Proverbs chapter 24. I'll show you what I'm saying. It's a building process. You cannot assume that you are ready for marriage just because you get married. You weren't here for our first class, right? So I taught us that everybody wings it. You jump in that plane because you rode in that plane 1,000 times. You never flew it, but you rode in it. You grew up in family and you just thought you could do marriage. And then one day you decided you're going to fly the plane just because you rode in the seat 1,000 times. I can fly this thing. And you take off and the next thing you know, your marriage is a mess, turbulence everywhere because you don't know what you're doing. And that is the metaphor of most marriages. They go in not knowing what they're doing. Listen to this. This is Proverbs 24. One, that's not the one that I want. I don't know why you're looking at that. Proverbs 24:3. Look at Proverbs 24:3. All right. So watch this. Through wisdom is a house builded. Do you see that? See the word is wisdom? Watch this. Through wisdom is a house builded. Here's our next word. By understanding is it established. So you need wisdom and you need understanding. Watch this now. The house is built on wisdom, is strengthened by understanding. Wisdom and understanding are critical. That's what you're getting in these classes. Wisdom and understanding are critical. Watch the next verse. Here's verse number four. Verse number, and by knowledge, is that verse three? Okay, there you go. And by knowledge shall the chambers be filled with precious and pleasant riches. Wisdom, understanding, and knowledge shall fill your house, the inside of your home, with the qualitative virtues that make for a beautiful house. That make, like, you don't just build a house if you don't have the skill set to build a house. And when you build a house that you want to last, you make sure you have a solid foundation. Then you build your superstructure. Then you fill it with all of the quality accessories you want in that house. Now it's attractive. Our marriages have to be that same way. So now pull up Proverbs chapter 19, I believe it is. Proverbs 19, verse 1. Watch this. So this is very important. Very important. You need wisdom. You need understanding. You need knowledge. Okay, so then that's not going to get it. Let me go back and look. Which this is just one more verse I want you to see. Oh, Proverbs 9. Yep, Proverbs 9. Proverbs 9:1. Here it is. So look at this. Proverbs 9:1. I want you guys to see this. So stay here. Here it is. Wisdom hath builded her house. So in Proverbs 24, it says you need wisdom to build a house. You need understanding to strengthen it. You need knowledge to fill it with right things. That's the relationship. It doesn't happen by accident. All engineers know what I'm talking about. Now watch this. Wisdom has builded her house. She hath hewn out her seven pillars. She has seven pillars anchoring her house. You know what pillars are? Pillars are those borders, those boundaries that establish the strength of the home. Pillars. They are those monuments that demonstrate the majesty and the grandeur of the home. Seven pillars. For this woman, wisdom here is personified as a woman. It's a type of the church, and it's a type of the godly woman. The seven pillars are those virtues that make sure that that home is established. That's in our PowerPoint. We will deal with that next time. What are those seven pillars? There are seven critical pillars that make for a happy home. Without those pillars, the wind is blowing. There are earthquakes coming. There are people who want to destroy your home. The enemy wants to demolish your family. Do you have the pillars that are critical to sustain the home? You guys see what I'm saying? Very important. Very, very important. So, a couple more questions. We'll shut it down. Right here and then over there.
Pastor Jess, if I heard you correct, you said that it was more egregious to violate the covenant of marriage than it was to be in contempt of the laws of the land.
That's right.
In court.
That's right.
That set heavy with me. Could you develop that, please?
Not really, other than to say this, that when God created the heavens and the earth, he didn't start with a judicial system. He started with a husband and a wife. You got that? And when it all ends, guess what it ends with? A husband and a wife, which is Christ in the church. If God were to destroy America, he could start it again with a believing husband and a believing wife. Because when God destroyed the world in the days of Noah, he didn't start with a judiciary. He started with a family. And the culture crumbles in the home first. The judiciary is simply a reflection of a weak and flawed domestic relationship atmosphere. If we as believing families did what was right and stood for what was right, we'd have everything we want in the court system. Are you guys following what I'm saying? The courts only can do what culture and families allow them to do. This is why the church is in so much trouble, because we are a culture-driven world and not a biblically-driven world. Does that make some sense? My sister. Oh, okay. Where at? Okay.
Okay, speaking about unbelievers, I have two observations. One would be if you're in a marriage and a person doesn't want to cooperate, they want to have independent behavior.
That last one.
But they tell you, says, well, you can't leave me because Jesus says only if you commit adultery, and you don't have any proof of me committing adultery. So if you walk out that door, you can't marry anybody else because the grounds of divorce is adultery.
That might be true. I mean, the argument, that argument might be valid, meaning he might be able to argue a little bit of Bible because, you know, he's unsaved or she's unsaved. Mm-hmm. And because they were sanctified by the spouse, they learned a little bit of Bible. Mm-hmm. And that's why they abuse you, because they figure you ain't going nowhere. You just, this ain't going to leave me because I know a little bit of Bible. I know this much. As long as I don't let her catch me committing adultery, she got to stay with me. Mm-hmm. But I would say that 1 Corinthians 7 would allow her to leave if he's neglectful and abusive and is destructive of the relationship. If the peace of the home has been destroyed because of a lack of mutual agreement, what 1 Corinthians 7 will say to that is that the unbelieving spouse can depart if they want to, or they can stay. The right. job of the believer is not to try to make them become saved. That's not your job. You can't make them become saved. But your job is not to stay in the marriage and let them destroy you and drive you crazy either, turn you into a basket case or a nutcase. And separation is always advised before divorce. That's what I mean. Sometimes some people are fools, especially men. Men are fools in thinking that their wives won't go anywhere. Well, just take a break from that brother for a second. See if he can run life by himself. And, you know, see what happens. Because if you still love him, that's really what you want. You want that to be a tool that will cudgel him to do the right thing. But you might discover he don't care. You might discover he doesn't care. Okay. In any event, that the man does not get to destroy the quality, or the woman doesn't get to destroy the quality of the home just because we're bound to each other. You can separate if you need to and stay unmarried. Sometimes some marriages are so bad, I would say to a sister or brother, why on earth are you going to get married again? Just stay single and be happy with Jesus. Right? Be happy with Jesus. Be happy with Jesus.
Pastor, I got part two. Uh-huh. So if a person, I look at it like this, if he's disrespecting me, don't have any value for me and stuff like that, I don't have to see him commit adultery, because I know when he's outside of my sight, he doesn't have respect for me, he doesn't have respect for God. So when a lady come on to him, he's not going to say, oh no, don't come on to me, sexy lady, because I love my wife. That's not going to happen.
That's good logic.
It's not going to happen.
You see what she's saying? That's good logic. That's good logic. And what I am dealing with, is what I am talking about, is the spirit of marriage. Because too long our culture has, you know, the pendulum swings. It's called the perilous pendulum. Back in the day when men had the dominant role of income provision and women had to put up with misogyny. And you guys know that's the case. Where the man could just dog you and dog you and dog you and you had no outlet. Today you do. You're educated. You want it. The workplace is filled with more women than they are men today. And, you know, you're not going to get a whole bunch of sympathy from me because I'm a pastor that has six daughters. Do you understand what that means? Six daughters. So I'm hypersensitive to the need for the marriage to have that spiritual component of respect and love and devotion. I am not going to advocate that my daughter sits in the midst of nothing but abuse and neglect and devastation of her character. I'm not going to support that. I'm not going to support that. So, hey, don't divorce, but step away until that man gets some sense. And if he don't never get any sense, that's bad language. Don't never get any sense. Don't step back in. Don't step back in. Your soul's welfare is very important. That makes sense, right? All right.
Pastor Jesse, I have a question. What would you say to a couple that...
You got to keep it up.
What would you say to the couple that the spouse, one of the spouses, is not willing to lay down his life for the other spouse?
I don't know what that means.
Well, because he has children out of the marriage.
But what does that mean?
That he's not willing to sacrifice for the marriage because there's children out of the marriage.
Which means what?
I mean, what would you say in that situation?
Is he giving all his money outside of the marriage, all his time outside of the marriage, or what? Because I don't know what you mean. Laying down your life
as far as meeting the needs of one of the spouses according to the covenant marriage, in emotional,
so you want to
financial,
you want to reframe
and so on.
Here's how you want to reframe that. If a man has children out of wedlock, which is, you know, where we are today. But he's married. His primary responsibility is to his wife. I said that last week. So, like, what I'm framing for us is a challenge for us. Because what I'm saying is, when you marry a woman, according to God, or a man, they are the most important person in your life. Until we raise it up to that level, everything else can actually challenge that relationship. Until we raise to the level that the husband and the wife are to view each other as the most important person, and then everything else is subordinate to that, you're going to always be challenged by outside and ulterior and other circumstances. Mama, daddy, uncle, brother, sister, job, friends, children, grandchildren, and all of those will become idolatries to the marriage. Am I making some sense? See, we haven't understood this, and so we have bought into compromised relationships, which divides people's allegiance, and then spouses feel left out. See, am I making some sense? Good, good. Because see, the thing is, you have to demand a high quality marriage. You guys have to demand that. That's what you want. You don't want a poor marriage. You don't want that. You don't want a paltry marriage. You don't want a marriage that doesn't resemble a marriage. But that means you're going to have to put in your time too. The policy of joint agreement, mutually loving one another, meeting each other's needs. Everybody ought to sign on the dotted line to do that. That's why I had us to audibleize that last week and again today. So that's your mission statement. When you get married, your mission statement should be, I married you so that we can go to glory together. And everything that we do in life is to facilitate us going to glory. We're not going to let anything stop us from going to heaven. Otherwise, there will be things that will abort that process and begin to tear you down, tear. You lowered the quality of your relationship to the point where it's embarrassing. And it ought not to happen. So we got to fight to raise that level in the church and teach and encourage and show how it can be done. So people covet being married. Covet, especially your children. I want your children to covet being married. Then our daughters will know what kind of man to get. They'll know. They won't put up with dragging any kind of old cat from behind the garbage can. Using the blow dry cleaners have before you drag him in the house. I want to show him to daddy. Show him to daddy. Daddy, you think this all right? No. 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 And unfortunately today, our children are not even following the protocol of making sure that those boys and girls that they get involved with are vetted by their parents. It's all broke down. It's all broke down. I'm not having it in my house. I mean, that's just, you know, I have the right to say that. So, like, you have to just start. You have to start somewhere and do it like that. And just don't succumb. You know, if you want to break it down and become culturally driven, out. We love you, but it's not going to happen here. Because I'm not going to allow us to start a trend where we destroy the possibility of our grandkids and our great-grandkids having a quality marriage. I mean that with all my heart. Anybody else? My sister.
Hi, Pastor.
Hi, sweetie.
Hi. My question is, so I grew up with, you know, my mommy and my daddy, and they have a great relationship, and it's so cute, and it's God, and like, you're like, oh, yay, that's what she should go for. But I feel like there's a step between single and marriage, which is dating, which you just talked about. Is there like a guide for that? somewhere in the Bible?
Mm-hmm. That is an element we need to work on, huh? Did y'all get that young lady's question? These young people talk so fast. I tell my daughters, I say, look, slow down. Because they're, boom! So what you think, Daddy? I don't think nothing. I don't think of that because I didn't even hear you. Could you back that up and just slow it down to 45 RP? Slow it down. Oh, now I hear what you're saying. But I've been knowing Aaron for a long time, too, so. There's a class that I'll teach. I hope to be able to get it. I want to try to get it in over our next two classes. And this has to do with the virtues and vices of touchy-feely relationship. The virtue and vices of touchy-feely. Y'all know where I'm going? Okay. The virtue and vices of touchy-feely. Because touchy-feely is deceptive. So we already talked about the dynamic of romantic and erotic attraction, which is a precursor to attachment, which attachment is designed to settle you down into the psychological, emotional, physiological benefits of comfort and security. But the hormones that drive us are sexual in nature. And what they do is break boundaries and cause us to explore in the philly touchy dimension. And the philly touchy dimension actually abrogates or disregards the critical intermediary processes of getting to know that person objectively and analytically and factually without getting clouded by the feelings. So all of our children who fall prey to the touchy philly dynamic are blinded by hormonal love. Am I making some sense? The touchy-feely stuff. So the touchy-feely stuff is what the scriptures warned about in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. It is not good for a man to touch a woman. Ooh. See how carnal we are? So am I making some sense? We're very carnal. Because some young men would not have a relationship with a woman. If he cannot have more than touchy-feely, he's got to have sex. You better not bring that dude to my house. I'm talking to my daughter. Because you don't understand your physiology and you don't understand how God made you. You don't understand that why he made us that way was to see to it that we head towards marriage. But the person with whom you are heading towards marriage, if they don't meet those necessary requisites, i.e., they are a person of character. You guys have a lot in common, a lot in common. That's critical to a really good marriage. We'll be talking about the things that lead to incompatibility. That was the next two Love Buster films that they're having, the things that lead to incompatibility. A lot of times people meet persons with whom they really don't have any compatibility. All they're doing is going through what we call an emotional, hormonal, horny escapade. And it feels good. It's called the touchy-feely vice. They're feeling good. Feeling good. Her and this dude don't have nothing in common. They are just as opposite as night and day. They just got all of the stars flying off. Am I making some sense? But now Erin is smarter than that. Because she's been around a while. Just like most of my daughters are. Most of my daughters. I got one that's 21 or 22. Glow is 21. Is Glow 21? 21. Glow is 21. Then I got Trent. Y'all met Trent. Remember y'all met Trent, the one that ain't getting married for 20 years? Y'all met Trent, right? Well, you know, the thing is that you have to understand how these dynamics work. So in dating, there ought to be rules. They're called boundaries. Boundaries. And I would say this, that the woman ought to be the one who sets those boundaries. This is the chivalry that the South used to have. This is the chivalry they used to have, where the woman expected the man not to cross the line. She expected him not to cross the line. But you guys are getting ready to go into the dark crevices of Romans 1 with me. And Romans 1 is going to show us that we didn't cross the line so far. We don't even know where the line at today. Ain't no line today. Right? Ain't no line. And so this is how you do it. You know, tell him. You know, if you touch me in the wrong place, my daddy gonna kill you. That's all. That's a start. if you touch me in the wrong place, my daddy's going to kill you. He don't mind going to jail for me. You see, I'm not smiling. You hear me? You touch my daughter in the wrong place, I'll go to jail for her. I'm not going to have an eternity-bound human being in the auspices of covenant and not protect her from some fool. I don't get to just throw her out there to the wolves. So I let her know, sweetie, now I'm just letting you know. You know, I'm ready to go get my number. I wear a medium. I'm going to buff up to a large in 6 months on the inside. I'm going to preach the gospel in prison because my brother's waiting for me anyway. I'm going to just let him know that dude touched my girl. That's why I'm here. Turn in your Bibles to 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 1. Let's get this going now. My daughters used to say, Dad, you used to scare these guys so much, they wouldn't even walk us to the corner. As soon as we get to the corner, we had to drop them off. They couldn't even walk us past the house. That's right. That's right. Call boundaries. Any other question before we shut it down? And no other questions? Good. Let's pray. Oh, okay. Right here.
You got another one.
Okay. Right here? Okay. Let's, yeah. All right.
Hi. So my question is on how to balance being newly married and having a parent live with you.
Ooh. Ooh. Yeah. Ooh.
Whoa.
Well, you know, no, technically speaking. Did I cut it off? Let's say that both of them were believers. No, I'm on. There we go. Let's say that husband and wife are believers, and mom is a believer. If we got believing family, it shouldn't be a problem. Mama should know how to stay in her place. She don't get to run nothing. She's a matriarch, and she gets to bless the children with her presence and her wisdom and everything, but mama don't run nothing. She get to run her own house. But if she living with hubby and wife, her daughter, mama don't run nothing. And she should know that she will destroy her baby's marriage if she thinks she can nosy in to everything that they're doing. Does that make some sense? And really all this is about is being believers. And then, you know, you give mama all of the rules of engagement, say, mama, read this. And watch the CDs, because this is how we working it in this house. Just wanted to let you know, my husband is the most important person in my life, and my wife is the most important person in my life, and us two will love you like we're called to love you, but nobody gets in between that. Okay. Another question?
So my question is just sort of to piggyback off of hers. So if you are single and, you know, you meet a gentleman and you guys...
Is he a gentleman?
I would hope so.
Okay.
But you enter into a courtship and you say you even get engaged or you're engaged now. I understand that the rules of engagement are really to be applied after you enter into that.
No.
Well, I was going to say how far, where do you, you know, because obviously
no,
you're...
No, the rules of engagement are at the beginning, like respect, like being able to cooperate and work mutually together to solve problems. Engagement periods are designed to discover whether or not that person is truly committed to monogamy with you at the highest level of relationship. That's what engagement is about. It's not just abiding your time like prison. No, that's to discover whether or not, apart from sex, can we actually negotiate life together on levels short of what marriage would call for once you're inside that covenant? To demonstrate whether or not you have those compatibility factors, can work through knocks and bumps and turbulences and setbacks and You women have all kind of stuff men have to work through, you know, those kind of up and down cycles. A man has to demonstrate he can ride those waves. Because y'all be doing this. And a man have to be able to ride these waves. If he can't ride these waves, he's going to be in trouble. Throw him off. Pick up a brother that got sea legs. Because you got to have sea legs when you're rolling with a sister. I know what I'm talking about. But it would work there. And the thing is you make sure you are walking in the light and getting counsel. You need to have authority over your head. The problem also with our singles today is they have no authority over their head. You need to have authority over your head that not only can speak into your life, but has authority to stop it when it's going down the wrong way. See, long ago we had the strong extended family relationships, but the enemy has destroyed all that. So we have isolated relationships, and that's where neglect and abuse fosters in isolated relationships. Am I making some sense? Long ago when you dated a young lady and she had five brothers, that was a nice boundary right there, nice check. See what I'm saying? All of that kind of stuff. Any other question before we shut it down? All right, let's pray. So, Father, thank you for this time, and I really do thank you for the patience of my brothers and sisters here and the longing and desire that we have to do marriage better. And so we're asking that your spirit will work in the life of every one of us here to grow us up in you in all things and cause us to treasure our spouses and to treasure our families and to treasure our God and to treasure his word so that we can enjoy life to the full according to the blessings with which you have promised to bless those that love you and keep your commandments. As we go our way, give us traveling mercies. Prepare us to worship you tomorrow as you ought to be worshiped. You are glorious. You are magnificent. You are wonderful. We thank you for being who you are. And we pray it in Jesus' name. Amen. God bless you guys.